A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Alexis the Midwife.
And I'm Becky the Doula.
Welcome to Notes from the Mother Box, where we will be having real and frank conversations about the highs and lows of the parenting journey. We are delighted that we have a fantastic partnership this season with Sophie Le Giraffe, especially because this year is Sophie's 60th birthday.
And we have some exciting things lined up in Sophie's honour across this season, including a special birthday celebration episode.
If you want to see the full range of Sophie Le Giraffe products, head over to sophielegiraffe.co.uk, and in the meantime, pop the kettle on, pour yourself a cuppa, sit back, and enjoy this week's episode of Notes from the Mother Box. Today, we'd love to welcome Emma from the Playful Den to the show. Emma is a mother of three, a kid culture expert, family researcher, and play advocate. And I could go on. A huge welcome to the show, and thanks so much for coming on.
Hello, thank you very much for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm so excited about this because my husband is very good at using humour with the kids, and I'm quite jealous because I can't get there quite as easy. It's not always natural, is it? Sometimes you've got to work at it. So I'm looking forward to hearing some top tips from you today, Emma.
Absolutely.
So as a midwife and doula, obviously we love a birth story. You have three lovely children. So what were your pregnancies, births, and transition to motherhood like?
Yeah, just a small question.
Just a small question to start.
So the three kids, there's quite a big age gap between the recent addition and the other two. So I have a son that's 10, a daughter that's 7, and then we have a 1-year-old.
Oh.
I've had three, well, I don't know what's the correct term for, do you just call it a vaginal delivery?
Vaginal delivery, yeah.
Three of those. And I guess relatively straightforward in that I didn't have to have many, you know, any sort of emergency C-sections or interventions or anything like that. Pregnancies, I mean, all the usual aches and strains and God, that last bit is just brutal, isn't it? I found the third with Scout, I was quite a lot older than when I had my first, and I did really feel that. I felt a lot, I just felt like, yeah, there's been a couple in there before. And it's sort of straining and creaking a little bit more than it did before. And I did really feel that on this recent pregnancy. And I think with this last birth, I really, so with Phoenix, there was sort of hypnobirthing and stuff. It was sort of around, but certainly not as kind of widely available and as talked about as it is now. And so I really sort of got into that with my recent birth. And I was very excited about that. And it was just something that I hadn't really explored before. And I loved that, and I found that really valuable during the pregnancy. I loved doing like all of the sort of meditations, and I used the Positive Birth Company resources, and it was great, and it definitely helped me. I do think, however, though, because it was my third and I had lots of sort of people around me saying, oh, you're just going to like sneeze this one out and you know, those sorts of things, I think my expectations were possibly too high. And I thought, this is like the last baby I'm going to have. I'm so much more experienced now. I've had two births before. I've done this hypnobirthing. I feel like I've got a vision for what I want the birth to be like, which I never really had before. I was just like, it's a thing that I have to get through and I hope it goes okay. So I think the expectations were a little bit too high, actually, because it was quite a long labor. And that sort of transition stage when the sort of baby's coming down was quite memorable, to say the least. And yeah, that sort of was a little bit traumatic. But I think it's quite, I did sort of take time to debrief with my partner on it, because in theory they're quite straightforward. Actually, there is a bit of trauma in however it kind of happens, really. So
we've talked about that a lot, Emma. Going off of that point again, I think it's a really good one, is that in theory, on paper, from the outside, all of these things that we sort of say, it looks like it was straightforward, but it really always just comes back to how you felt. And if you look back on it, no matter what it seems like to other people, that's real. That's what's true for you. And I think that's what you've got to work with afterwards. And the other thing I was going to say quickly was, as I've had three children as well, and I don't know if you find this, Becky, with all the women you've doulaed with over the years, the third baby can be a bit of a wild card, don't you think?
We literally always say when somebody books in with a number three, we're like, oh, because...
Could go either way.
It can go either way. Yeah. So quite often it can be super, super fast, or sometimes it can be the longest, sort of hardest birth that somebody's had. And we don't know why. We don't really understand the science behind it yet. But definitely we know, number three, weirdly, number four, you just know it's going to be fast. But number three, it's kind of, it's a funny one. It's,
often number three births like a number one.
Yeah, that's true. My second birth was so straightforward and... quite short, definitely like the most enjoyable, easiest one. But the third was definitely more like the first. I didn't realise that he was back to back. No one knew that. So he did turn at the end. And that's why I was getting so stressed, because I didn't recognise the pain. Yes. It felt so different. Like it felt like he was coming out my spine. And I was like, I don't know what's going on. And it was so painful. I was just on the gas and air, which I quite works for me. Mm-hmm. But I was getting very high. And but it's funny, because there's probably only about 20 minutes of that labour that was like I look back and shudder, and the rest of it, hours and hours and hours, like before I was like totally zen, and I was doing like the rhythms and the hypno, and I was on the mat, and it was like so peaceful, and it was sort of have had dark lighting, but you just remember, you sort of remember the worst parts, don't you? So I kind of had to readdress that after the birth, because I felt, because I'd had these expectations and this vision for how I wanted it to go, and it didn't really sort of map out like that. Mm. Also, I had to be on the monitor because he'd done like a poo in the womb, and I was just like, ugh. So afterwards, I sort of had to sort of readdress that, because, you know, if you look at the whole labour, it was actually really peaceful, and I did feel really in control. But you have the strongest memory of the bit that was less so.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think that's quite typical.
It's great that you did the debriefing, though, because I think that really helps, just to kind of go through it all in your mind, and then you can sort of almost box it away a little bit, that bit, and just
And I think my husband, you know, he was really affected by it, because I think, it's quite difficult to just watch someone that you really care about. And you can't really do anything. So I felt like I wanted to do it for that for him as well.
Yeah. Oh, fantastic. Amazing. So you both did the debrief together?
Yeah.
And he felt like he got a lot out of that experience as well.
Yeah. And I think, we'll come on and talk about the playfulness, but we apply playfulness to everything. And, you know, we were able to bring some humour to that debrief of the labour. And, you know, that's certainly a strategy that I use in a lot of areas of life. And I think, I don't know, I've always used humour alongside motherhood wherever is appropriate, because sometimes it's like, if you don't laugh, you will just cry forever. strategy that worked for us.
I've got to tell you about this thing, Emma. It's just, I don't think Becky's even heard this story. So I'd just like to add here that I did theatre studies A-level. So when I had Toby, honestly, I found, that's my eldest, who's almost 10. I found it so full on, just such a huge change in my life that in a weird way I wasn't expecting, even though I'd been a midwife for 6 years before then. Because let's be honest, generally in midwifery role, you look after someone during, antenatal appointments, birthing the baby, the postnatal period, really only up until about 10 days, and then off you go. And with Toby, it was probably a few months in. He was a really insatiably hungry baby. He was a big 9-pound-3 baby when he was born. And as one feeding expert told me, he was a high need baby, which I'm not sure was a very helpful way of referring to him. But one morning, he had not stopped crying all morning long. And he was in his little baby Bjorn baby bouncer. And I was on the cusp of just losing it, just bursting into tears myself. And I went out the room for a breather. And then I thought, this thought crossed my mind. And I opened the door just slowly into the lounge. And I went, do, 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 do. Hello, boys. And I came in and I did the full, you know, Sweet Charity. The yeah. minute you walked in the joint. Ooh. And honestly, he stopped crying because of the shock of his mother going to full musical theatre mode. And it turned this moment, yeah. which is something that Emma, you talk about a lot, and you talk about the importance of playfulness for mental yeah. health, for yeah. mental well-being. It turned this moment of, frankly, despair and feeling just like, I can't do this. What am I doing wrong? Into a moment where I was just cracking up by how hilariously ridiculous the whole thing was.
That's it. Yeah. So, that's it. Yeah.
It's so powerful, isn't it? It's so
that's
powerful.
The power of play. Yeah. And it's like, you get these moments, don't you? It's like a balloon sort of fills up and the pressure fills up that yes. balloon. And then it's like, how do you want to pop it? Do you want to pop it with, you know, a meltdown and shouting and crying, which, you know, sometimes is appropriate. Mm. Or do you want to pop it with, you know, playfulness? You've got control of your mindset, and you know, it costs nothing and it's not easy. And I'm not saying that, you know, every single moment I'm like, yay, yeah, jazz course. Hands, because that's unrealistic. But it is a strategy. And yeah. I think a lot of my followers are mothers, and I'm particularly interested in just talking more about the fact that you are allowed to have fun in motherhood. You know, it is your time to enjoy. That does not mean that I believe that the experience is universal for everyone, or that it's easy, or that there aren't challenges. But alongside those things, you can still have fun. You're allowed, yeah. You have permission. You're allowed to enjoy it. You're allowed to have humor. You're allowed to play. And I don't see so much of that in the sort of discourse around motherhood and coping with the stress and the tension. So that's kind of what I try and bring to the table.
Totally. And I completely get that. And also being a mum of three as well, the amount of times over the years, especially when Wilf joined our family, who was our youngest and completed us, we're done having kids now. The amount of people that just went, oh, you got your hands full. And it just felt like such a negative narrative. Yeah. I was like, we've chosen three children. This is what we wanted. Yes, of course, there are moments when it feels really full on and tough and I'm juggling like crazy. But there are also moments when I feel so incredibly grateful. And I think, wow, like I couldn't be more lucky. I can't believe, especially coming from a fertility journey that I had with baby one, how was I so fortunate that I ended up, you know, with these three amazing kids. And I love also that you talk a lot, you know, you don't shy away from the challenges of parenthood. It's not like you're just like, come on, we only talk about positivity here. No. Playful Den is about sort of reframing things. I love the yeah. idea that you talk about choosing joy, and it yeah. is those little moments. Like you say, it's not always possible. And I'm curious as to where your focus and your interest steered, because I know you had another career before you focused completely on Playful Den. How did it become so important for you for this to be the focus of where you were going?
Yeah, so my background is in research and sort of brand strategy. So I founded an agency 10 years ago. So I've always been a working mother. Mm. I've done all sort of variations of childcare and numbers of days of working imaginable, but most of the time has actually been full time. Mm. So for me, you know, one of the biggest challenges has been getting that balance right, splitting my time, managing things like guilt, that feeling that you're being pulled in multiple directions and you're never quite able to fully give, you know, it feels like you're never quite able to give enough to either. So that really for me has been probably one of the biggest challenges. I have a supportive partner, and that for me has been sort of like the biggie. And that has led to, you know, I've had periods of burnout and sort of quite significant, I don't know what they call them, I guess, yeah, burnout, sort of stress-related breakdowns. You know, the more I sort of moved through them and the more I learnt and sort of sharpened my ability to make boundaries, to block my time, to switch off, to switch modes from sort of running a business to sort of parenting, that the sort of better I got at those things, I observed that the more time that I spent playing for myself, I'm talking about here, not directly with the kids, the easier I could manage stresses, the more I could float through things, the better my resilience got, and just generally my well-being was better. And because I've been a children's researcher, that has meant that essentially my sort of sixth sense or sort of unique skill has been to look at the world with childlike wonder. That was my job, to understand how children see the world and how they think and feel and behave. And those two things sort of really sort of collided for me. And I just became increasingly interested in play and the theory of play and the sort of threat of play and how it's kind of more absent in a sort of culture that really overly focuses on productivity and traditional success and that sort of thing. And yeah, just decided during the pandemic, when I think lots of people were reframing their priorities, had quite a lot of momentum behind me, really positive feedback and motivation from my community, and decided actually I want to walk the talk more. So I'm gonna quit my big girl job to play and see what happens, and sort of really, yeah, commit and dedicate myself to understanding and doing more in this space.
And I wanted to just, I completely agree with you, and Playful Den on Insta, and we'll put all the information about it in the show notes, is a fantastic resource for people to go to have a look. Parenting, like you say, just working out that balance. And it also really interested me, which is why I reached out specifically to you, Emma, because I loved what you were doing. And it took me back, because when I was back in my midwifery sort of clinical days, I then had this really amazing opportunity to join something called the Family Nurse Partnership. I don't know if you've heard of them before.
No.
The reason why it's relevant is because basically they're a team, and it was an American program that was put together and brought over to the UK to offer intensive, really brilliant continuity of care to teenage parents. And I was based in London at the time. I was a teenage pregnancy midwife before this. And when I went into Family Nurse Partnership, you work with your young parents to be from the moment they find out they're pregnant through until their babies are 2 years old. And a huge part of what we would do was teaching and learning together how to play with children. So literally getting down on the floor and talking about scaffolding, and talking about dancing and not wrestling with children, and sort of just finding that place to meet them halfway and not taking over their play, but very much the scaffolding idea was supporting them to sort of learn to build those bricks and grow their imaginations. And it was a glorious part of the program that I thoroughly, thoroughly enjoyed. Every time we had a play session, I really, really enjoyed it. So when I saw the work you were doing, and not just for teenage parents, but for everybody, I thought how valuable it is. And I just, you know, well done you, because I think, I know it's a big step to make moving over to doing it exclusively, but it is, I can't wait to see what's ahead for you and the Playful Den.
And it's amazing how, when I used to work in the clinic for postnatal depression, often women have toddlers and babies, and so we would sort of look at a bit like you, Leckie, how they could play, how they could kind of, you know, come out of the fog and, you know, force themselves out of it through play. And it was really surprising how many people didn't know how to play, and maybe hadn't, and actually also hadn't played as kids. Yes. That seemed to be a running theme. And so one of the games we used to do was to, it was almost like a Simon Says, but it was a funny walk game. So everyone got up, and we'd get, if there were any toddlers there with us, we'd say, right, you do a walk and all the adults have to join you. And it was so funny how stiff all the adults were, and they couldn't. And then eventually, by the end, the kids would set the funny walk and we'd all have to follow. And we'd all be in floods of tears of laughter. And you'd see these women with these sort of heavy clouds just momentarily be lifted out of it. And it was amazing. And that was just by copying somebody's silly walk around a room, you know. Yeah. So it's really simple, isn't it? But really hard for some people to get there, to access it.
Yeah, and it's so beautiful what you describe, Becky, because that is exactly it. So play is when you do something that is intrinsically motivated and you get temporary pleasure. So it's not like, you know, you do a little bit of play and your life's going to be fixed. Yeah. It's I see it as similar to, you know, we talk quite a lot about things like self-care and relaxation and sort of different methods for well-being. And it's so like it should be at the top of the list because, as you exactly said there, it's that lifting of the cloud. And it's because, you know, unlike some of the other sort of techniques for managing stress, mindfulness and things like that, what you get with play is the joy. You get this massive dollop of joy. And it can just be as simple, as you say, as moving your body in a silly way. It doesn't have to be complicated, but it's those things. You do it for intrinsic motivation. So you're not doing it for anyone else. You're not doing it because you're going to put it on social media or because you're going to look cool or because you want to show off to anyone. Like, it's just, you're doing it for the sake of it. It's like, do more things just for the objective is fun. And then you get the temporary pleasure. And also, nothing bad ever comes out of play. If it does, then it's not actually play. It's something else. It's dependency or whatever it is. But nothing ever bad comes from playing. So it really can be that that simple, but the power is immense. And as you describe with your teens in the sessions, when people get to touch play in a way that perhaps is a little bit deeper, or they haven't quite thought about it in that way before, it's very like magical to them. And that's because as humans, we want to play. Like, that's our natural state. Like, when we're born and we're babies and we're toddlers and when we were kind of primates, like, we learn and we discovered through play. But as we grow up and we become more conditioned and all of the shoulds kick in, we stop playing, we stop becoming curious, we stop asking questions, we stop going towards what's joyful for us because we think it's not appropriate, or we have to be grown up now, or we don't have time for it. But it's actually what we crave to do all of the time. So when you have a moment where you connect with play, both of which, how you're describing, you've sort of seen it in action and you've sort of touched maybe a bit more on the theory of how it works, it's kind of like, wow. Like, wow. And that's like the response that I get from a lot of the content that I create, because it's just so innately natural to us as humans.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
We hope you're enjoying our chat with Emma so far, but now for a little ad break.
We are really enjoying partnering with Sophie Le Girard for this season of the podcast, and we'd encourage you to head over to their website, sophielegirard.co.uk, to discover some brand new Sophie products, as well as the whole range which is available directly on the site. We have been on our social media showcasing just a small sample of what you can find over there, and we'd love to see your photos with Sophie. So please tag them with hashtag SophieLeGiraffeUK and hashtag NotesFromTheMotherBox.
And now back to our chat with Emma.
I know we're thinking about and we're focusing on, you know, parents and children and thinking about that side of it, but are you going into, I know at the moment with the pandemic, you can't really at the moment, but is the plan to go in and work with adults that's got nothing to do with parenting, just adults playing, adults in the workplace, you know, just allowing their imaginations to take over for a little bit again and exploring the power of play with outside of the sphere of parenting? Is that something that Playful Den will be doing at all?
Yeah, I'm very passionate. I probably feel more passionate about getting adults to play more. I mean, I have a lot of background in kind of kid culture and I'm very interested in that. But the impact that getting play into an adult's life can have, I think, changed the world, can change how people communicate, can change how people connect with each other. I'm very fortunate. I live on the coast and I live by the beach, and I had a sort of penny drop moment a couple of years ago, because I'm like obsessed with the beach, as lots of people do. And then I realized, I was like, oh, one of the reasons why I love the beach so much is because everyone is at play on the beach. And like, when you look around a beach, or there's other environments as well where that happens, and you just get that sort of feeling, and it changes people's energy, people's mood. So it's this sort of mindset for me, like, for play, play for children is very much an action, you know, it's an activity, it's what they do, it's how they communicate. They're doing it all the time. I think for adults, play can really be a mindset, an attitude, and this sort of playfulness that I talk about a lot, I think, is made up of these four characteristics: joy, curiosity, creativity, and openness. That's a sort of playful spirit, if you like, that I think in the culture that we live in today, which is very polarized, which has a lot of existential crises that, you know, we're all sort of freaked out about, I think we can massively benefit from all having a bit more of a playful lens on life.
Yeah, definitely. And going back to the sort of parenting side of it, you use the expression getting out of the weeds, and sort of, and it does feel a bit like that sometimes, doesn't it, with parenting? Because there's always your to-do list. There's always that sort of, oh God, I've got to do this, and I've got to do that, I've got to do that. And that can suck the joy out of your day-to-day, and almost like you can't free yourself up to get to those moments of play. So, like, what would be your top tips if someone's feeling so pulled under by parenting in general? Any advice?
Such a good question. And it starts so early. You were talking about how people react to you. Oh, you got your hands full there. And it's like, as soon as you're pregnant, like, oh, wait, you wait.
Yes.
And I would say one of my tips would be choose another word other than parenting. Mm. Like, I think that word has become so loaded and so heavy. I choose dream coach because I think that's fun, and it makes me like feel like, you know, that's what I want to do. I want to coach their dreams out of them, and like, that's fun. And like, you know, give yourself another label if you're getting bogged down in the weeds. And then also, it's what I said about remembering that you're allowed to have fun. You're allowed to have fun, and really have a look at where you place what has value, because quite often with parents, and particularly with women, we place more value on our productivity, what we've got done, how much work we've done today, how many emails we've sent, how many loads of laundry we've done. Like, that's where we place our value, and we see first and foremost our role as essentially jobs, you know, as responsibilities. And again, I'm not saying they don't exist, you know, we have to all kind of get that stuff done, but just make sure that the other stuff is weighted with more value, or at least equal to that stuff. So whether that's like, you know, rather than thinking how many loads of laundry I've done today, how much eye contact have you had with your baby today? Because that's the good stuff. Like, that should be as important. Like, how have I done something silly today? Have I done something just for fun, even if it's just for 30 seconds? Like, when I'm walking around, am I observing and taking in things that I find joyful? Am I noting them? So it's really sort of just realigning where you're placing value, because quite often we want to go towards the weeds. We actually want to focus on the negative. That's kind of how our minds are wired. So you have to do the work. Like, you kind of have to take fun seriously. And if you are not getting any of that in your life, and if you live your life by a to-do list, I would just be making sure that that to-do list has 50% things on it that are about fun and joy and connection, as much as it is about productivity.
That is so true. And
because you do forget, don't you?
Yeah.
Like, you know, how often do we have a huge to-do list, and you only feel better if you get to the end of that to-do list, you know? And kind of, I spoke to Lecky about this when the kids were young, minor teens now, but when they were younger, somebody told me about love bombing. You know, there's a book called Love Bombing. And so we called it a yes day, and it was a day where they were in charge for the day. And it was brilliant. It was the one of the best things we did. But I was surprised by how much I enjoyed not being in charge.
Yeah.
And Ella led the day and just saying yes to everything. And yeah. It also made me realise how much I say no, how much I say, can you wait a minute, please?
Yeah.
And the day for us was such a tonic, like it restored us both for quite a long time. Her behavior was amazing afterwards, and but I think I needed it more than she did, actually.
You do that. It's the playfulness, and these things are so linked. So when we stop playing, when we stop being curious, the more that we do that and the more that we take on productivity, responsibility, oh god, I'm a parent, we enter into what we call a fixed mindset. So when we're in a fixed mindset, we don't consider possibilities. We do say no all of the time. We stay on these rails that we believe if we step outside of them, we're going to lose control and something bad's going to happen, or you're going to be a bad parent, or, you know, the child's going to go to bed late and it's going to be the end of the world. Like, we have a fixed mindset, and a fixed mindset is a really not a nice mindset to live with. It's really not, because you're closed down to possibilities. So that's why you say you needed it, because you've stepped off the rails. You've basically let go, and you're allowed to. The world is not going to implode. You know, we're allowed to be flexible and to be spontaneous, and as I said, to enjoy ourselves.
Absolutely. Amazing. I also really enjoyed on your, I think you can still see it on your Insta stories, your discussions, or you refer to it as your pep talk, over children and how they dealt with home learning, remote learning, or homeschooling, however people want to refer to it, during the lockdown last year when kids are out of school, and then the lockdown again. And I know that you're very passionate, and you gave the pep talk about children falling behind, being out of school. It feels like a lot of people got in touch with you and said that they were very concerned, that their kids were going to be taking a back step with their education. And you went on, and I think people can go to The Playful Den.
It's on my highlights. Check out.
It's still in your highlights. And it's really useful. I watched them all. I found them incredibly useful, because I had a big concern. My daughter, who's in the middle, is dyslexic, so that was something that, you know, she struggles so much still, age 8, really still with her reading. So that was something that I was worried about myself. I'm dyslexic. My youngest is in reception, so he's just starting out, and we did get an email from the school quite early on saying he hasn't submitted much work since he's been at home. And I'm thinking, we're both running jobs, the kids are out of school, it's incredibly trying. And then I was looking at your pep talk. Can you talk us through a little bit more, falling behind what, question mark? This was your stance, so can you go into that a little bit more, Emma?
I mean, god, what a brutal time for everyone, but for parents and for families. The pressure was through the roof, and we live in a very comparative culture anyway, because we're all looking through each other's windows at what we're doing. And on top of that, here in England anyway, we have an academic system that's very archaic, and is very dependent on these sort of stringent markers and tests and assessment, and all of that compounded, and it was, as I said, absolutely brutal for parents. And what I was hearing, and I was getting a lot of messages even from parents of children at preschool, actually, that were feeling, my child is falling behind, I'm really concerned, and also were having day upon day upon day of battles with their child to get them to watch a Zoom lesson, or get them to fill in a worksheet, or whatever it was. And it was creating incredible levels of tension in the home. And what I just felt was very sad was everyone was, again, it's the priorities, isn't it? It's like the most important thing that everyone was looking towards was tick boxes of learning, which clearly you cannot replicate what happens in a classroom with the expertise of a teacher and face to face in sort of emergency learning at home. And teachers did an absolutely incredible job of being agile and doing what they can. But it's like sometimes the parents don't feel like they're empowered to actually say, my child is in distress right now. My child is also five. Like, yes, they've got a long time at school ahead of them. And actually, you know, we're arguing for hours about this, but I can sit down and read a book with them in the evening. I can do a bit of Duplo with them for and it's like we just don't value other things as much as these sort of tick boxes of learning. And it's incredibly complex because there are children with different needs and different circumstances. But all I was hearing was these parents just, you know, they're going in the bathroom, they're crying, it's a pressure cooker. And I just felt so sad and so compelled to just say, you have to put first and foremost, like, what your intuition is telling you. And children under seven are all basically geniuses. Like, their imagination and their creativity is mind blowing. And there's actually an opportunity here to play, which there should be a lot more play in our education system. But unfortunately, as I said, it's quite archaic. And it just felt very sad to see, you know, all of these parents just feel completely disempowered. And there's something wrong there massively. We're in an emergency situation. So I just felt compelled to just try and empower people and give them the information and to try and, you know, raise the status of play, because it actually does more for children than kind of what they're learning in school at those very young ages.
On that note, Emma, I was just going to say that we have, like I've mentioned, we've got three children. They're all in school now. We've got the two boys, we've got a daughter in the middle. And we did end up, after 3 years of our daughter being very, very unhappy in a mainstream educational environment, which worked incredibly well, it seems, for our son. He just breezes through. She's 18 months later, completely different experience. Truly miserable. I mean, absolutely miserable. Sunday nights in our house was torturous. Absolutely tears. I felt like I had to force her to go in, and it felt barbaric, to be honest with you. And the teacher would just say she was hiding under the table again today. She tried to run out of the classroom. We had to send her for time out. Then I remember on one particular situation, just talking about this archaic schooling thing, trying to get all the kids through their SATs. Becky knows, we've talked about this. It's had so much airtime between us. And then on one particular day, she was really upset during phonics, because we know now that she's got quite significant dyslexia and she finds it incredibly hard and frustrating. She wouldn't sit down and do it. So they took 15 minutes of her lunch break away from her, where she was meant to be playing outside. I know what you're going to think here, because it's just awful, isn't it? And honestly, when she told me that, it just broke my heart and it just made me want to cry. I was like, you are punishing her by taking her playtime away from her because she feels so awful about her, you know, her reading abilities. And anyway, we ended up moving her school, and now she goes to a different one, to the boys. And in the first week she was at the new school, her teacher took me to one side and I was like, here we go again. And she said to me, oh my goodness, your daughter has got the most incredible imagination. You must be so proud of her. And I honestly wanted to burst into tears.
Yeah.
Ivy's bedroom is like an art room. Like, it's literally like, you know, the art rooms at school. It's like that. Yeah. Like, there's paint everywhere. There's crayons all over the place. It's an absolute mess all the time. She has this incredible imagination. Yeah. But what she doesn't feel good about, and what she finds is more challenging, is sitting down and working towards SATs and things like that at school.
Yeah.
And that was a moment for me as a parent, just thinking, thank goodness we were in a situation where we could do that for her, because I don't know how much longer as a family we could keep putting her through that experience.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny, isn't it? Like, sometimes we treat children in a way that we would not be satisfied with as adults. Imagine if we all had to do the same job.
Yes.
It would be absolute carnage. We all have different skills and different strengths and ways of communicating, different parts of our brain that, like, you know, it's and that's the unfortunate situation, is that it is one system, one way of learning, which is very reliant on memory and very reliant on doing things at speed as well. So much of what is in the curriculum can be learnt by most people, but absolutely not at the same speed. Yes. Like, it is madness, the volume of stuff that they have to learn. So And I just find that very sad because, you know, the idea of, you know, a free education system is so exciting to me. Like, imagine, like, it, you know, it should open doors for everyone. And unless you happen to line up with that particular learning style and you land in a class where, you know, you've got, you know, a teacher that, that, is empowered and has the resources and time to support you, which unfortunately, you know, teachers are very sort of handcuffed by the system and they're not allowed to exercise their their actual skills and ability. A lot of children do end up becoming quite anxious, not very happy, and they fall out of love with learning at an age which is just criminal,
isn't it? Well, she just decided, she said, I'm no good at this, mum. She said that at 6 years old. She told me, I can't read, I can't do this, I'm no good at learning at school. And I remember saying to my husband, how can a child of six write themselves off? That's insane. And I was, you know, and at the time, actually, I have to say, the year before that, she had this teacher at her primary school who I had a real soft spot for, actually. Went travelling around Thailand the year afterwards, so I was a bit sad that the other kids didn't get to see her. But anyway, she used to say to Ivy, we'll sit down and do reading, and if we can get through 10 minutes reading of a week together, because she'd by this point really got an aversion to sitting down and reading because she felt so useless at it. She said, what would you like to do more than anything? And this just tickled me pink. And Ivy wanted to go into the classroom next door and sing a solo to 30 children.
Wow.
Exactly. So I'm thinking to myself,
not many people.
Come on now.
That.
Where are the where are the points for that? Like, there's not many 6 year olds who perhaps would feel comfortable doing that. And I know I'm a bit biased, but she's got a voice on her. But I was just thinking to myself, but this is what you get missed out on when there's, you know, there's certain expectations, is that perhaps some of the more creative, more arty sides of things get a bit of a back seat. And I think that that's a real shame.
Again, it's how we value things. So we value, you know, the English maths way, way above singing and dancing. And why? And that's why I say falling behind what? Like, it's literally what a bunch of people have set as a sort of standard, but that's incredibly subjective. And it's what, you know, one group of people have said, these are the most important things to get out of schools. Very, very subjective.
But play also helps you to learn, doesn't it? So my youngest daughter has sensory processing difficulties. So actually play's become a massive part of our family for self-regulation and, you know, it really helps her. And when she was in primary school, she had to have sensory breaks. So she'd have to go out and have a runabout. So we got very used to using our bodies. And so one of the things that the OT suggested was to sort of have some fiddle toys, you know, because movement helps you to concentrate. But she didn't want to use it because she didn't want to sort of stand out, you know, because they have to sit cross-legged very, very silently on the mat like these little robots. And the teacher that she had, luckily, was brilliant. And she said, don't worry, I'm going to use my class budget and I'm going to buy every child a fidget toy because they all fidget. I spend half of my time telling them to sit still. And it was amazing because, bless her, she was an NQT. So I think she was really sort of hadn't been worn down yet by the education system. Yeah. She bought every kid a fidget toy and she said they have never listened so well. Their work is amazing because they're all fiddling while they're listening to me, but they're really concentrating. And I just
thought
that was
a good example, isn't it, of going with the child rather than trying to control them in a sort of adult-centric way.
Yeah, I thought it was amazing, actually. And she really saw a difference in their kind of ability to listen to instructions to what she was saying as opposed to switching off. So
wasn't it amazing. Einstein who said that if we judge everybody, if we judge a fish by its ability to climb a tree, then it will always feel like a failure?
Yeah, he's and got it's like the best quotes.
It's just incredible, isn't
he's
it?
A big play advocate as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
My girls are teens now. Actually, they do still like craft. When they were younger, we were like uber crafty family. In fact, sometimes I borrow Lecky's kids
she
to do
is.
Craft.
She puts me to shame.
She
looked after my son a couple of years ago and he came out and he'd made all these like jungle animal masks. And I was just like, oh, Becky, you're so good at this stuff.
But I really enjoy it. That's the thing, isn't it? But so many of my friends hate crafting or, you know, painting or like messy play. And how can we tap more into that? Because you know, lots of them really do want to do it, but it's almost getting over, it's the mess again, isn't it? It's like another job, I think.
We all have things that sort of trigger us, don't we? And for a lot of parents, mess and sort of keeping control of the house also allows us to sort of keep control of our mind, I think, and how we feel. And for a lot of parents, you know, messy play is incredibly stressful for them because they see it, they have to put themselves in this role where you know, they're sort of telling them off, or it gets out of hand, and then they sort of have all these fears. I think the thing about play is it actually thrives very well with boundaries. So I think sometimes, you know, when I'm trying to help parents with how they're playing with their kids, they think that to truly get to the full experience, they need to just let the kids do whatever they want. And that's what they're very fearful of. And that's not true, actually. If you set the boundaries, the children know that within those boundaries, they can do whatever they want. And they actually get more creative because there's some sort of limitations there. And they know, like, you know, what they are and aren't allowed to do. So I think you just, you know, if you do have an issue with sort of messy and play and kind of things like that, it's just like, what are the boundaries that are going to make you feel comfortable? You don't need to make a big deal out of it and, you know, come down like a ton of bricks. It's just like, we're going to do this. It's going to be awesome. It's going to be really fun. But this is how we're going to do it. It all happens in the bath, or it all happens in this big box, or it only happens outside, or it only takes place on this table. Like, whatever it is, you just put the boundaries down.
I know you talk a lot about, we've touched on it a little bit already, going out in nature. You live by the beach. Becky and I live in Brighton, so we're right there with you. And we've got the South Downs behind us, and then obviously we've got the beaches along the South Coast. Something I wanted to ask you about, get your advice about, Emma, is that we often say to the children, especially on the weekends, if they're, you know, at a point where they're back in school, we need to get out, my husband and I, for ourselves, for our mental health. And often what we're finding at the moment, which is something that's sort of evolved over the last couple of years, and I don't know whether it's come from lockdown and our daily walks, the kids have almost associated it with a negative thing. So on the weekends, when we say we want to get down to the beach, we want to go for a walk in the South Downs, we get a wall of no way, I'm not going out for a walk, I don't want to do that. But every time we finally get out, and it's normally sort of an argument to-ing and fro-ing for about an hour and a half, they have a great time. We have a lovely, lovely time. So I just wondered if you've come across that before, and if that's something you maybe have a couple of ideas about.
Yeah, isn't it just so frustrating? Yeah, I work with Dr. Rudkin, a child psychologist, and we always talk about this. She calls it the torture walk in her house, because it's like you're asking them to sort of do something that's, you know, going to inflict bodily pain on them. Yes, I would love my children to bound up to me and say, I want to go outside, Mum. I want to go for a walk and explore. But no, that's not the case. I don't know if we're just wired for comfort and we're all just inherently lazy, and as adults we're able to say, I know I need to go out and get some fresh air because it's going to make me feel better, and it's going to boost my mental health, and I'm going to get my steps in. That's just not how children think. So you have to remember that children live in the present, so they do what they want to do in the moment. So they don't necessarily have the ability to have the foresight to think, once I'm on the walk, I'll love it. And after the walk, I'll feel great and I'll be able to have my screen time guilt-free. Like, that's just not how they think. So
that's such a good point. And can I just say, sorry, just pausing on that point. That's so true, because also while you're on the walk and they're rambling and they're, you know, picking flowers and they're checking out, you know, whatever they're doing, they're also not thinking about the fact that an hour ago they were squealing and saying, I don't want to come on this walk. They've forgotten that period of time, and they are just in the moment.
Yeah.
You know, that dopamine, that joy juice is on the way out and they're having a good time.
Yeah. So thinking sort of forwards and backwards is almost like time travel for kids. Like, it's a strange concept for them. They are like, when's my next meal coming? What is happening right now? What is happening in the next 30 seconds? And what's in front of me that I'm doing? Like, and as parents, and I think particularly us in the generation of parents that we are, we're always thinking about the future. We're obsessed mm-hmm. with the future. We're making decisions based on the fact that we're worrying. We don't know what jobs there's going to be or what the state of the environment is going to be. We are obsessed with future-proofing our kids. And it's a massive tension that we don't even really realize most of the time, because our kids are in the present and they are just about what's happening now, and we are constantly an eye on the future. So I think once you realize that, you can perhaps change your expectations, or, you know, understand that a little bit more about why they react. Someone asked me very recently, actually, like, how do you get your kids to like walks? And I just said, I don't. You can't make anyone like anything. And, you know, if you've ever, I don't know if anyone's ever tried to get you into something. My husband's always trying to get me into running, and it makes me not want to go running. And he's just like such, you know, loves it. And he's just like, I know that if I got into it, I probably would like it. But the fact that he is trying to make me like it makes me not want to get into it. So I don't think you can make them like anything. All you can do is set up the circumstances for them to have a nice time.
That's so true, Emma. And I just also want to say, right, my husband said to me recently, I'm turning 40 next year. He genuinely asked me, and anyone who knows this will know how ridiculous this is. He asked me if I wanted a mountain bike. Becky, come on now. But the thing is, Emma, that's what makes him joyful. He loves that. He loves that, despite the fact that he slid off a mountain bike once and I saw him afterwards, and believe me, it was a mess. He still wants to get back on that bike and go back up there. For me, I was like, I don't know how to say this without sounding like the not fun person in our relationship, but I don't really want to go mountain biking, and I certainly don't want you to buy me a mountain bike to do it. But I think that is helpful when you think about, again, this is play in parenthood, isn't it? This is play in adulthood, of us as adults and what we enjoy personally, and then the kids as well. I think that's a really, really valuable message to take away.
And I think the information that you give to your children, adapt it for their personalities. Some kids, it's better to just be like, that's it, we're out, shoes on. You don't even need to tell them particularly what you're doing. Other kids, you might need to say, we're going to do 30 more minutes of this TV show and then we're going to X park or whatever. So I think sort of adapt the information that you give and when you give it that suits the personality, the character traits of the child.
I love that, actually. I remember a friend of mine coming over and pre-COVID, and her kids were playing, and she knew that them leaving is always quite difficult. They don't like to leave. And so she was like, watch this. And she got out her phone and she said, I'm going to have to put the leaving timer on. And they were like, oh, and she's like, oh no. And she put it on, and basically when the timer goes off, but what was really nice is that when she went in and the timer had gone off, she totally like empathized with their sadness. And she was like, I know, it's such a shame, isn't it? So rather than going in and going, we have to leave and la la la, she was like, I know. And then they were a bit like, oh, and they were mutually sad and left with no problem. And I was like, that is genius.
all kids want is their feelings validated. That's all they want.
So finally, we always ask our guests at the end of a show, if you were to write a note going out in a mother box to a brand new parent with your best bit of advice on it, what would it say?
I would say reconnect with your inner playful kid. What are the things that you did as a kid that brought you joy that you can get into your life during this new life stage that you're entering into? How can you get them in? Do you want to pick up your hula hoop? Do you want to get back into swimming? Were you actually really adventurous? Like, how are you going to get little mini adventures into your day? Like, tap into your inner playful kid, extend a hand to them and say, you're coming with me on this new life stage, because you're gonna need them.
I love that.
Absolutely fantastic, Emma. Thank you so much for coming and joining us today.
Thank you.
This is definitely going to be an episode I'm going to go back and re-listen to it time and time again, just to remind myself when I'm feeling, like you say, I'm in that fixed state and I need to just, you know, have a talk with Kid Alexis and get back to playing again for myself and for my family. Thank you so much, Emma.
Thank you for having me. It's been great.
Thank you, love. It's been really interesting.
Thank you, darling.
Thanks once again to the joyful Emma for joining us today and sharing her passion for play with us.
If you enjoyed this episode and want to know more about the work that we do, look out for our books, The Little Book of Self-Care for New Mums and The Little Book of Self-Care for Mums-to-Be, where we will talk further about birth, parenthood, relationships and much more.
We've really enjoyed this episode. We're sure that you all have your own stories of your bubbers and their love for our partner this season, Sophie Le Giraffe, and we would love for you to share them with us.
Send us your photos and your stories to our Instagram at Notes from the Mother Box, and don't forget to tag at Sophie Le Giraffe UK on Facebook and Instagram to share your pics with her too.
Join us again next week for more chats with another amazing guest.
See you next time on Notes from the Mother Box.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.